are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 17th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alexander Hertel Fernandez, author of State Capture: How Conservative Activists, Big Business, and Wealthy Donors Reshaped the American States and the Nation. Also on the program today, Iran announces an increase in its uranium stockpile as the Iran deal begins to unravel. Meanwhile, Donald Trump does not like the looks of his internal polls and has thus beheaded his pollsters. Supreme Court rules in favor of the Democrats in a gerrymander case in Virginia, but it is mostly a question of standing. New York Times claims that U.S. attacks Russia's power grid in retaliation for Russia cyber attacks. Trump is angry. Elizabeth Warren and James Clyburn to introduce a student debt bill. Buttigieg raises $7 million in April and praises Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Saudi Arabia may execute a teen for his past protests. And Bibi Netanyahu christens a new town. If you lived here, you'd be nowhere. Trump orders agencies to cut at least one-third of its advisory boards. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. It is Monday. Glad you could be here with us. Still basking in the glow of a wonderful Father's Day. Kids made me breakfast in bed after waking me 3 hours earlier. And then proceeded to not let me sleep tonight, last night too. So, but it was very sweet. And Mila made her first hard-boiled eggs.
Oh.
She was convinced she could not do it, but she did it. She literally boiled water.
It's magic.
Yeah, total magic. I hope your Father's Day or weekend was good. We are all here, except for Michael, of course, because today is Monday, and it is the second or third, fourth Monday of the month. Michael's Monday. Michael is Monday. There you go.
He did post a very cute picture of him with his dad.
Oh, did he? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. There you go. Still in recovery mode, I guess. So they released the big Donald Trump, George Stephanopoulos interview, of which we got a couple of clips this week, right? There was the clip about him saying that there was no collusion, and then there was the, what was the other clip that we played? I can't remember now because it was almost 3 days ago. Oh, right. I don't need to go to the FBI if somebody comes in. You know, let's say Norway gives me some information about somebody. And then of course, every official involved in elections said, actually, that's you probably that's not you need to. It's illegal.
I'm going to hear about it first, see what it's in there.
So I don't know. I think after the Mueller report, the idea must have been by the Trump administration Now we can finally subject ourselves to a non-overtly and overly friendly media person for the first time in probably months and months. And Stephanopoulos seemed to press him on some things. And apparently they're also going to... This is just a bizarre moment that ABC let the cameras run. It's unclear. Apparently there are some in the media who are suggesting that this was on purpose, that Mick Mulvaney, who you will hear coughing in the background as chief of staff, was upset with the direction that these questions were going and coughed as a way of basically resetting things. I don't think it's going to quite work in the way that they thought it would, because I think they presumed like, oh, they'll just cut. I think Trump thought like whenever someone coughed in the middle of the Apprentice, we would just cut and do a whole nother take. But news people, of course, are just going to let the camera roll. And if they're going to find that moment, and in some ways, that's the most newsworthy thing, I think, and could be the most problematic for his supporters. Like, wow, this guy just like take two. I mean, I think most politicians can do that. It's just there's very little opportunity and value to seeing it, I think, from the perspective of news people, although it might be helpful to watch this of all politicians. But here's Stephanopoulos at Donald Trump's desk. They've got to do something about his tanning regime. But here is Donald Trump with Stephanopoulos.
When you will see my financial statement at some point, I assume it's going to be released, you'll be very impressed with the job I've done. Much, much bigger, much, much better than anybody. They're after my financial statement, the Senate. They'd like to get my financial statement. At some point, I hope they get it.
You're going to turn it over?
No, at some point, I might. But at some point, I hope they get it because it's a fantastic financial statement. It's a fantastic financial statement. And let's do that over. He's coughing in the middle of my answer.
Yeah, okay.
I don't like that, you know?
Your chief of staff.
If you're going to cough, please leave the room.
Get a shot of, and I'll come over here.
You just can't.
Just to change the shot.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, you want to do that a little differently then?
Yeah, we just changed the angle. Okay. Yep. Thank you.
So at some point, I look forward to, frankly, I'd like to have people see my financial statement. Because it's phenomenal. No, it's not up to me. It's up to lawyers. It's up to everything else. But they're asking for things that they shouldn't.
I don't even understand what he's talking about, financial statement. Is he talking about his taxes?
It sounds like
his taxes. Why are they looking for his taxes in the Senate? Wouldn't the House be getting his taxes?
He doesn't know that.
Well, it doesn't appear that Stephanopoulos knows what he's talking about. The whole thing seems wrong, and maybe that's why he was coughing, because he's like, wait, what? You're offering your financial statement?
Well, there was
the
early part where Stephanopoulos did ask for clarification once, and Trump's just like, you know, my financial statements.
And Stephanopoulos just went with it because he's like, who knows what we'll get out of this. I also like how he realized, like, oh, I have to reset, because the camera hadn't reset. Take three. Clapper. Oh, we're just going to go? Okay.
Because it's phenomenal. No, it's not up to me. It's up to lawyers. It's up to everything else. But they're asking for things that they should never be asking for, that they've never asked another president for. They want to go through every deal that I've ever done. What they're doing is a disgrace.
What other presidents have turned over?
They're trying to do step. They want to keep it going as long as possible to try and demean and hurt as much as possible so they can possibly win the presidential election.
I mean, there's some truth to that part. Certainly, the party out of power will be doing things to win their presidential election. I think there's probably also a lot of pressure to do more of that, certainly by grassroots Democrats. Democratic leadership seems to have a problem with that. But...
Yeah, it looks like he could only be referring to his tax returns, and that would be the House. But
yeah.
And I hope Mick Mulvaney is okay.
I, you know, it. both, there's two scenarios, right? The way to watch that. One is that either it was a setup and it was a little ham-fisted. Like, Mick, if there's a problem, cough. Yeah. And I'll pretend like I'm mad at you. And then we'll reset. But he didn't really reset. He just kept going. And otherwise, it just makes Trump look like more of the Mad King in this instance. But
or there is a God and Mick Mulvaney is dying of consumption.
That also would be nice. Would be nice if there was a lot of TB floating around that office.
Precisely.
But I don't know if we'll be that lucky. But who knows? They had a very strange moment there.
I don't like coughing.
Hey, folks, finding a new job is a lot of work. What if you had your own personal recruiter to help you find a better job? Well, now ZipRecruiter's technology can do that for you. Just download the ZipRecruiter job search app. Let it know what kind of jobs you're interested in, and its technology starts doing the work. The ZipRecruiter app finds you jobs you'll like and puts your profile in front of employers who may be looking for someone like you. This is interesting because we've advertised ZipRecruiter multiple times in the past, but from the perspective of an employer, I've used it as an employer. We also have someone in the office who used it as an employee or a would-be employee. Brendan over there, don't be shy. He knows how this works. If an employer likes her profile, like I did Brendan's, ZipRecruiter lets you know. So if you're interested in the job, you can apply. And that's what happened to you, right, Brendan? I don't think they had the app at the time, though. That would have made it easier. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated job search app. And based on a third-party survey, 7 out of 10 people who found a new job on ZipRecruiter increased their salaries. Well, did that happen, Brendan? Okay, good. It did. There you go. Boom. All right, don't get carried away. You don't have to get...
over the course,
as opposed to today, as opposed to when you started working here. There were results of a 2017 U.S. survey of over 500 ZipRecruiter users who got hired for a job they found on ZipRecruiter. But this is the best job you've ever had, right? That you said that very quickly, folks. The best job. Download the free ZipRecruiter job search app today and let the power of technology work for you. Don't wait. The sooner you download the free ZipRecruiter job search app, the sooner it can help you find a better job. I know this is true of just about everybody in the office. Are you trying to drink more water? Liquid IV hydrates you 2 to 3 times faster and more efficiently than water alone, with the added bonus of vitamin C, B3, B5, B6, and B12. It's the fastest growing wellness brand. You can find Liquid IV everywhere, even at Costco. Use Liquid IV to fuel tough workouts, help prevent muscle fatigue, promote healthy post-workout recovery. It's a great alternative to traditional sugary sports drinks because there's no artificial flavors or preservatives. In fact, it's non-GMO, vegan, and free of gluten, dairy, and soy. Better yet, it comes in convenient TSA-friendly powder packets that are perfect for travel and preventing jet lag and altitude sickness. That's where I use it the most. And also the sickness that comes maybe when I travel, I drink a little too much. But I got my daughter using these when I feel like she's dehydrated and starting to get a headache. She's one of those type of kids who gets a headache a lot because she's doesn't drink enough water over the course of the day. And so I want to get as much water into her as possible.
I mean, same.
The same, right?
Yeah, I need someone to make me do that.
We've blown through this. Well, you can call your dad.
I guess I could.
But I get my daughter to do that. I give these things out as gifts. Well, I haven't done Halloween, but I love Liquid IV. I know you will too. Right now, my listeners get 25% off at liquidiv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order on Liquid IV's website. Just go to liquidiv.com, enter my promo code MAJORITY. That's liquidiv.com, promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Start properly hydrating today. And lastly, it may feel like cybercrime is something that happens to other people, but stealing data from unsuspecting people on public Wi-Fi, it's one of the simplest ways that hackers make money. When you leave your internet connection unencrypted, you might as well be writing your passwords and credit card numbers on a huge billboard for the whole world to see. Protect yourself today with ExpressVPN. It secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. ExpressVPN has easy to use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, phone, and tablet. Turning on ExpressVPN protection only takes one click. It costs less than $7 a month. Look, there's so many public Wi-Fis now. It's starting to happen around Brooklyn quite a bit now. If you're using these things for anything of import whatsoever, you got to use a VPN service. ExpressVPN is rated the number one VPN service by TechRadar. It comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Super easy. You get the app, you click it, you're all set. Protect your online activity today. Find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/majority. That's ExpressVPN, ExpressVPN.com/majority for 3 months. Free with a 1-year package, the expressvpn.com/majority to learn more. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Alexandra Hurdle Fernandez about state capture, how conservative activists, big business, and wealthy donors reshaped the American states and, sadly, the nation. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Assistant Professor of International Public Affairs at Columbia University and author, most recently, of State Capture, How Conservative Activists, Big Business, and Wealthy Donors Reshaped the American States and the Nation. Alexandra Hurtle Fernandez, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So, much of what you've talked about here, you know, I've been aware of on some level, but the depth of research that you've done is fascinating, and it's nice to sort of have like this stuff looked at almost clinically, if you will. And let's just start with the right wing troika, as you call it. What is the right wing troika, and how long have they been, I guess, operative?
Yeah, so I suspect many of your listeners, like you, have heard of some of the members of the Troika before, and there's been some great newspaper coverage of them. But what I try and do in the book is really pull together their entire history and understand how they've worked together, the sort of strategies that they've deployed, and where they've been most successful and why. And so the organizations that are part of the Troika that I study in the book include ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, Americans for Prosperity, or AFP, and the State Policy Network, or SPN. And they've been around for a while. ALEC got started in the 1970s, SPN got underway in the 1980s, and Americans for Prosperity is the most recent group. It got started in the mid-2000s, in 2004. And they're different organizations. They organize different constituencies. They're supported by different donors. But the reason why I call them the Troika and I study them together is that over time, they've been pushing a similar policy agenda, shifting state policy all across the country to the ideological right, especially, but not exclusively, on economic issues.
And they seem to, well, I mean, and part of the work you've done here is to sort of explain how that has happened, but they seem to fall into place and sort of complement each other, I guess, and have become to some degree enablers of each other, right? Like they all, it's almost like a conveyor belt, and they all have a different sort of station that they're at.
That's exactly right. The way I think about it is that each of them has carved out a specific niche of strategies that it pursues, and they work together, pushing in the same direction for very similar policy ideas, and in many cases, identical policy ideas. So ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, is in charge of the idea generation. It has companies, lots of Fortune 500 companies as members, along with conservative activists and philanthropies, including those affiliated with, for instance, the Koch Political Network, and they're developing model bill ideas. In some cases, even the exact legislative text that it wants state lawmakers to pursue. And then it distributes those model bill ideas out to all of its members and encourages members to adopt it by giving them everything you need to enact those bills. It's sort of like a bill in the box. They give you the idea, the research that you're going to need, the talking points, and they'll even connect state lawmakers with people who will testify on behalf of that legislation or lawmakers in other states that have succeeded in passing that bill. So that's the ALEC component. The State Policy Network is a network of conservative think tanks across the states, and they produce the research reports and testimony, media commentary to back up all of the model bills that ALEC is producing. And in some cases, SPN affiliates in the states are participating in ALEC as members. So they're helping right from the get-go to provide the sort of intellectual and research base for conservative ALEC ideas. And then Americans for Prosperity operates outside of the legislature. It's sort of the grassroots army, the boots on the ground that provide the heft to get those bills through the legislature. So Americans for Prosperity has over 3 million grassroots activists spread out all across the country, state chapters in over 35 states with paid staff. You know, in many ways, it's like a political party. It's got these local, state, national offices and grassroots activists. And, you know, they'll mobilize their members to contact state lawmakers to push them to enact particular bills. They'll threaten to run campaigns against lawmakers that don't support ALEC model bills. And they have campaign contributions that they can direct to ensure and threaten lawmakers that don't toe their line. So in that way, you know, ALEC works inside of the legislature. SPN provides the support for those bills. And then AFP operates on the outside.
Someone like Scott Walker, it seems to me to be sort of the perfect encapsulation of a political regime slash era location that brought all of those elements together in a very successful, from their perspective, way, and one that was really damaging and nearly became fully nationalized in that moment. And I should say, you know, one of the things that really I think is sort of, well, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We can talk about Wisconsin. But so you have these three entities working together. What are the myths that you write about that that surround the way that these entities work. Myths, I think, that are in many respects obviously generated on the left that maybe cover up the fact that the left has done such a bad job of not even like executing, like even contemplating competing on in this territory.
That's exactly right. As I talk about in the book, I think on the left, amongst activists, politicians, and some pundits, there are some myths that have formed about why the Troika has been successful. For starters, I think it's easy to look at the success that the Troika has had in states like Wisconsin, but also Michigan, Iowa, Kentucky, Missouri, and say, well, they're successful now. They must have always been successful. But as I try and show in the book, there were a number of points throughout these organizations' histories when they could have gone belly up. You know, ALEC, for instance, almost went bankrupt once, and the State Policy Network really struggled to get off the ground in its early years. And I think if the left wants to seriously construct counterweights to these organizations to build power in the states, you know, the left has to understand not only what made these organizations successful, but the ways in which, you know, they nearly failed. You have to understand both sides of the coins to understand why an organization is really successful. So what are some of these myths? I think by far the most prevalent one is that it's all about the money. You know, you hear from progressive donors or progressive organizations that it's just not possible to construct something like ALEC or Americans for Prosperity on the left because there's not enough money to do so. And it's true, there are a number of very deep-pocketed conservative donors, you know, most notably the Koch brothers and the network that they direct that raises, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars each election cycle. But there's a lot of money on the left as well. And as I show in the book, there's been a tendency on the left to raise money and spend it in very inefficient ways. So when I look at efforts that the left has engaged in to construct counterweights to, say, ALEC, you know, they've tended to focus on organizing in states that already have progressive strength rather than across the whole country, which is something that ALEC did very deliberately in its early years. I spoke to an executive director for ALEC that emphasized how, you know, he was trying to build power even in moderate and purple states in the 1980s. And those sorts of organizational efforts in the 1980s really, you know, they took years to pay off, but they paid off in a big way in states like Wisconsin, where the groundwork was being laid for decades. And progressives need to do something similar there. Well, you know, another way that I think.
Well, I want to get into it because this is a little bit of a ballywick of mine. Because the myth is that the amount of money is insurmountable for the left, but the quality of the money, like what the money does and what funders will fund, seems to me to be different. I mean, there was one chance. In the past 20 years, as far as I can tell, the most serious attempt at even recognizing that this was a problem was Howard Dean's 50-state strategy, which was almost immediately junked as soon as Obama won. And that wasn't even necessarily that was more just, you know, focused on electoral, which, of course, is certainly an important part of it. But that was just like one part of what would be your Troika. I mean, what is it that you found that the quality of the money that was coming from the left made something like this so difficult?
Yeah, you're putting your finger on a big part of the story, which is that there is money there. It's just a question of whether or not it's going to be deployed in ways that are helpful for the left to build this sort of long-term power or not. And as I show in the book, there were some big obstacles there. For one thing, progressive donors, foundations, and individual donors have tended to focus, you know, with near laser-like focus on the federal government. And it was very hard to convince them to direct attention to the states. You know, if you look throughout history at the times when progressives have started to try and build this cross-state power, it has tended to be during moments when they lacked control of the federal government. So you saw this during the Bush administration. You saw this again under the second half of the Obama administration when the Republicans controlled Congress. But what you see is as soon as Democrats have a chance of regaining national control, the money flows right back to Washington, D.C. to focus on Congress and the presidency. Now, don't get me wrong. That's really important, but you need to also be building that state capacity year in and year out. It's not something that you can just switch on and off like a light bulb. You need to invest over decades in building this kind of infrastructure, as I sort of alluded to with the construction of Alec. You know, it took them decades to really become successful.
So why do you think that is, that the left, center left, however you want to describe it, is it that they don't realize what you're saying? Because it seems fairly obvious. It just seems, but I like my sense is that the money doesn't want, there's almost like a too much of a preciousness with the money coming from the left. Like, I would hate to expend money that is just a bet that's not going to work. I would rather go for something that is like sort of like I can see material benefit from. Like, I'm curious as to the extent that you have any you spend any time talking about like the mentality of the money. Like, what is it? It can't just be that they don't realize how important it is. It's just like there's something that I think the money that comes from the left doesn't enjoy it in some way or something. Like they don't expend their money in the same way that the right does.
Yeah. So I do try and get at that a little bit in the book with some interviews I've done with progressive donors and going back through the archival record for some foundations and some donor groups on the left. And, you know, I think there are two factors here. One is sort of a worldview that until recently really prioritized policy change at the federal government. You know, I think, as I show in the book, there was a tendency to think that, you know, real policy change, at least on the left, couldn't come about at the state level. You know, when progressive donors, they write about in the book, thought about the states, they thought about Jim Crow and all of the ways in which state governments have used their power to oppress minorities. And they also thought about the ways in which states are pretty constrained fiscally. You know, they can raise taxes, but often state legislators and governors are worried about losing businesses or wealthy individuals. And so, you know, the thought was, if you really want to do big redistributive things that move money to disadvantaged Americans and help minorities, that has to be at the federal level rather than at the states. And of course, there's an element of truth to that. But if you look throughout the broad sweep of American history, major progressive initiatives, even at the federal level, have started in cities and in states. You think about the New Deal, the Great Society, even earlier progressive era reforms. A lot of those were sort of tested and developed at the state level before going national. I think another issue on the left, and this is changing somewhat, but another issue has been that it's been harder to fund long-term organizational infrastructure building rather than sort of one-off specific Yes. projects with clear individual goals that you can track very closely over time. You know, what is the outcome measure that a funder would use for building cross-state power? You know, it's hard to know what that would look like. Certainly over the long run, you'd want to know, are you flipping legislatures? Are you passing progressive policy? But that's a really long-term goal. So what are the sort of deliverables or metrics that a funder would use in the interim to know if they're building power or not? That's a much trickier question, and I think one where funders are on the left are only just starting to think about ways to track the effectiveness of their giving.
That second one is really interesting, because that's always been sort of my theory too, and it's a little bit that the left funders, maybe by virtue of being on the left, maybe there is a desire to have a sort of a more creative perspective on their money. And so the idea of doing one-off project and being able to say, like, I in some way, you know, created this, is more important to the left than it is to the right. And the idea of funding something that's operational that may not have a payoff for 10, 20 years and will be much more subtle in its payoff and much less attributable to, you know, one individual is just not as satisfying. I mean, that to me seems like a genuine problem that is difficult to overcome. And let me ask you this. I mean, if that's the case, and if that's your sense as well, do you think there are mechanisms in which to reevaluate the implications of funding, you know, operational things as opposed to sort of projects. If there's a way to sort of reevaluate, reassess, and repackage those successes that could appeal to the left, have you seen anything that touches upon, you know, that's starting to come close in that regard?
Yeah, I think you're right that for any one individual donor, there's a tendency to want to see, you know, your specific interests, your pet projects grow over time, and you're more reluctant to sort of fund just a small piece of a bigger infrastructure building operation. And I think that's where donor collectives or donor consortia, as I've called it in some other work, come into play. And so on the right, I think the Koch seminars directed by Charles and David Koch, the billionaire libertarian industrialists, have been really effective at this. So when we talk about the Koch brothers, we tend to think about the brothers themselves. But really, I think the most impressive thing they've done is assemble a network of 500, 600 other really conservative, wealthy people that all agree to pool their money and give it to the priorities that the Koch brothers and their top lieutenants specify. And so when you join the Koch seminars, you have much less autonomy over how you direct your money than you would if you were just giving that money on your own. And that's allowed the Koch network to build up organizations like Americans for Prosperity that require concerted giving year in and year out from a broad base of donors. On the left, there is the Democracy Alliance, which was founded a little bit before the Koch seminars, but in many ways is trying to do a similar thing, which is to say, it's trying to pool resources from wealthy billionaires and millionaires on the left in order to construct organizational ecosystem. And so it's funded a lot of important progressive organizations like the Center for American Progress and Media Matters, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. But over time, what you've seen is that individual donors have had a lot of ability to sort of direct their giving to the specific organizations that they want. And the upshot is now that the Democracy Alliance tends to pool money and spend a little bit of it on a whole bunch of different organizations rather than pooling that money and spending it on a small subset of organizations. Although I think they're trying to shift that focus, and I think a shift in that focus would be beneficial in order to build up the infrastructure that we're talking about, especially at the state level.
Are they having success? I mean, I don't want to spend too much more time on this, but I think is fascinating because I've been aware of the Democracy Alliance for over 15 years, and as far as I can tell, they have not in any way sort of had that the horizontal nature structure of that organization strikes me as one that has basically kept it from doing anything that's been super meaningful with long-term implications. It's almost as if they all gather together to pool their money and then decide, okay, now that we've pooled it, we're all just going to expend it as if we would as individuals.
Yeah, I think you're right to say and indicate that individual donors in the Democracy Alliance just have a lot more autonomy to give money where they want than folks who are joining the Koch seminars. And it's hard because I think on the left, there's a tendency to want to prioritize small d democracy. You know, if you look at the Koch seminars, they're sort of a top-down command and control Leninist operation, whereas the Democracy Alliance, rather ironically, is more like a free market where everyone is sort of allowed autonomy to invest in the causes that they care about. But my sense is that the Democracy Alliance has recognized this as a weakness of the organization, and they're trying to pool money to invest in infrastructure. And they've created what they're calling funds now, that where donors give money not to specific organizations, but to a fund that then tries to support infrastructure building in key areas. And the states are one of those areas that they're trying to build out those pooled funds in.
Okay, so what? Money, or at least the amount of money that is lacking on the left is one of the myths. What are the other myths in terms of the left's ability or left's perspective on what the right has achieved?
So I think another big myth on the left is that it's easier for conservatives to work together because they're all on the same page. They all want smaller government. They all want lower taxes. They all want to retrench access to the franchise and these other anti-majoritarian reforms. And I think that that is a big myth, because as I go through the history of these organizations, like ALEC in the book, I find that many of the different parts or many of the different members of these organizations wanted very different things that sometimes conflicted with one another. So take ALEC, for instance. You've got private sector businesses. They want lower taxes, but sometimes they want subsidies and they want measures like additional regulations that make it harder for their competitors to compete with them. You know, that in some ways is expanding the size of government. And you've got them in the same organization as libertarians like the Kochs that are against any and all regulation, any and all taxes and subsidies, even those that benefit businesses. And then, of course, you have social conservatives who care about things like abortion, care about things like welfare reform or gun rights. And for many businesses, those issues are toxic. They don't want to be associated with them. And so ALEC had to work very hard over time to come up with organizational mechanisms for getting all of these diverse actors to basically play nice with one another and agree to support common issues. And as I talk about in the book, a key innovation that ALEC and other conservative organizations at the state level engaged in was teaching all of these different and diverse actors on the right that they should prioritize power building above all. So I think one great example of this is the sort of attacks on the labor movement that we've seen from groups like ALEC. You know, ALEC managed to teach businesses, activists, in the social conservative world and the libertarian world, that if they all prioritized anti-labor reforms, that would weaken progressives and Democrats and make it easy for those other actors to pass their own individual pet interests, like gun rights or like anti-abortion efforts or like cuts to taxes. And so you've seen that playbook in the states that have flipped to Republican control, where the troika is very strong, like Wisconsin. What's the first measure that gets pushed through the legislature? Well, it's attacks to public sector unions, which then make it harder to for progressives to defend against things like cutbacks to the minimum wage or cuts in taxes or environmental standards that are favored by these other constituent groups. And I think it's been much harder for the left to prioritize those kinds of power building reforms. You haven't seen the same kind of effort to get all of the diverse interests on the left together and agreeing to commit to a common agenda.
I mean, this is just devastating. I mean, it's incredibly clear that this is a major problem for the left, right? I mean, we're supposed to have card check when Obama was elected. We see the right understand the relevance of the courts and all the gerrymandering that took place in 2010. I mean, and do you have any sense that on the left there is any more appreciation for this dynamic than there ever has been? Because, you know, I just think of like the Wisconsin State Supreme Court race that took place, I don't know, what was that, 5 months ago, 4 months ago? That race was so key as to empowering all the work and that had been done to elect Evers and a lieutenant governor in Wisconsin, and to, you know, perhaps change the makeup a little bit of the assembly there, which is way out of whack because of partisan gerrymandering. And the left somehow just did not mobilize in that election, which to me is like, it's obviously not the only thing you want these organizations to do. But if you don't do that, you can't do the rest.
I think that's exactly right. For a really long time in the organizations on the left that I study, there's been a reluctance to think about political change and policy change as being a tool for building power. I think progressives really like to think about using policy to improve people's lives and think about improving social and economic outcomes. And that's important. But if you aren't building the political power, you're not ensuring that those policy reforms are going to be around in a year, 4 years, 8 years. And as you mentioned, I think there's been a huge oversight on the left in thinking about labor in this way. You know, the labor movement's important because it raises standards for workers and ensures fair treatment, fair compensation. But it's also important because labor unions have been the backbone of the Democratic Party and of the progressive movement. And as I've shown in other research, when states pass these anti-union laws like right to work, Democrats are less likely to be elected from the presidency down to the state legislative level. The Democratic Party and the progressive movement is weaker. And so I think labor reform and other power building reforms really have to be the first thing that progressives push through when they gain power at the state level and at the national level. And I think as the years go on, Obama's decision not to push through card check and the Employee Free Choice Act is going to really seem like a big oversight that's hurt the Democratic Party. Now, I think that's changing. I've seen in the Democratic primary, for instance, a much greater willingness of the candidates to talk about the importance of the labor movement and reforms that could bolster the labor movement. And at the state level, you've seen some really important changes, both in blue states. You've seen California and New York pass measures to help public sector unions in the wake of the Janus Supreme Court case. That's the Supreme Court case from 2017 that applied right to work essentially to all of the public sector. But you've also seen it in some other states as well, like Nevada is going to expand collective bargaining rights for public sector workers for the first time. So those are all really important steps, but I think there just has to be much more of that, not just in labor policy. You know, expanding access to the franchise too, I think, should be one of the first things that progressives do to sort of help build their political power over the long run.
And so what's the next biggest myth that you think, similarly, I guess, tasks the left to do?
When you're thinking about state legislatures, I think there's been a tendency to look at the success of ALEC and say, they have model bills, therefore we should just have model bills and they'll fly off the shelves and that'll be that. You know, we'll build an organization that is just as effective as ALEC. And you've seen groups over the years try and create their own model bills, post them on a website, and then sort of expect that to work on its own. And certainly ALEC is successful because it has model bills, but it's more than model bills. It's about creating long-term relationships with networks of state lawmakers and building up trust over time. ALEC is successful because it can offer, a deep set of resources to lawmakers, things like research help, being able to call someone if you have questions about a bill, being able to understand what the bill actually does, being able to get talking points and up-to-date research from leading academics that defends your bill, and of course, having annual meetings that bring together state lawmakers so that you can build those relationships and networks, because ultimately it's that sort of relationship building that builds the trust that lawmakers need in order to rely on these model bills. And so in the progressive organizations that I've studied, you've seen a reluctance to invest in those sort of longer-term efforts to build out these networks and relationships and research resources that I think would have been necessary in order for them to really counter ALEC. And that's more generally true, I think, of political organizations on the left, that there's sort of a tendency to carbon copy the specific strategy that is seen as being effective. In this case, it's model bills, but in other areas, it's different things. And I think that just doesn't work. You need to look at the broader way in which organizations are operating, and you can't just carbon copy individual tactics and expect that to work on its own.
So lastly, Alexander, who is this book for? I mean, who are you hoping, we're talking about entities like the Democracy Alliance. We're talking about an understanding of the Democratic Party leadership, both in the state and on a federal level, needs to start to contemplate that the first things they do should be to solidify and increase power when they gain a certain modicum of power so that they have some durability and some long-term prospects to actually implementing, the sort of the policy sets that they're being sent to Washington to do. Like, who is this book for? And have any of those people been reached? And are they going in with a PowerPoint with your data and saying, look, this is why you're losing?
I hope so. I've been in touch with some progressive donors and some advocacy groups that are trying to bring lawmakers together across the states, and I've been heartened by the appetite around that. I think progressive donors and organizers and state lawmakers realize the power imbalance that we see across the states, and so there's a hunger for ideas that can help explain why progressives are in the hole and what they can do to get out of it. And so I think the book is meant to be a guide for anyone who cares about these issues, but especially folks who are serving in government, who are running organizations that try and move state policy or federal policy, and people who are supporting those organizations, like foundations and donors.
Alexander Hurtle Fernandez, the book is State Capture, How Conservative Activists, Big Business, and Wealthy Donors Reshape the American States and the Nation. We'll put a link to it on majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on. I had a great time.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, there it is. You need that data. It's all there. The stuff about the donors is something that, you know, I think we've talked about on this program for a couple of years, just at least in my anecdotal experience. That is part of the problem with the left, is they don't like to fund operational things. They like to center left. They like to have things that they can say. This is the Sam Cedar project for the blankety blank.
To register voters this year, basically?
I mean, it's something so that, like, oh, I increased voter turnout by 10% and I get a 6-month, ability to perceive my success or failure, and that I can actually look at something that has, you know, finite edges and is defined in such a way that I can say, like, that was me. And I think to a certain extent, it is whatever the sort of the brain synapses and MOs that make someone of the left as opposed to the right. I think that's part of it. I think there's just an idea of, like, I want this. This is an extension of some form of personal expression.
Yeah, I think you're right. I also think even a lot of progressive Democrats do not understand the need for independent working class institutions like strong labor unions.
Yeah, I think that's been a problem, not even just with labor independent institutions. One of the first things that Obama did, and I specifically asked Senator Sanders about this exact thing. One of the first things Obama did when he took office, or when he got elected, was to take OFA, Obama for America, which was a behemoth. I mean, talk about a networked army of grassroots activists and would-be activists. And they specifically, basically, I mean, just took that to the slaughterhouse, because they did not want a challenge on the outside that could go rogue, I guess. I don't know. They were specifically keeping people from funding outside organizations starting the day after the nomination in Denver, after the Democratic convention. And there is a psychological problem. And it's also with the big money. I mean, in addition to the money not having as aligned interests as the, you know, some of the groups that they might support, or the, you know, maybe you get a little nervous about supporting a legislature that 5 or 10 votes away from getting a little bit more aggressive on rent control, or getting more aggressive on taxation or whatnot it is. And so, but I think that the problem that overrides that is just more like, yeah, no, I just want something where I can say, like, you know, I'm responsible for this. I mean, I understand that impetus. I mean, I can't even have a boss.
Must be nice.
Must be nice. It's nice. All right, folks. Going to take a quick break. Head to the fun half where our members represent my boss. Many, many bosses. So many bosses. And you can be one of them. You can yell at me for being late. You can scold me for bringing in, you know, a tuna fish sandwich into the office and be like, what are you doing? It's smell is infringing upon everyone. These are just some of the benefits of being the boss around here. Enforce a strict dress code. You'll notice Matt hasn't worn that red stained shirt in a long time, have you?
I don't know where it is.
It's underneath the couch. But you can become a boss of me by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you become a fraction of a boss of me. You have fractal bossitude over me by becoming a member for just pennies a day.
Ours is a bossful movement.
Indeed. So bossy. Plus, you get extra content and you get your show commercial free. If you're interested in the deals that we offer, you can always check out the podcast description. We will include that in the member show as well. Let me just also say, look, we've been having a little trouble lately, not a huge amount, but a little bit of trouble lately with some of the members' feeds and whatnot. Part of this is a function of a redesign of our back end and just learning new habits in terms of posting things. Part of it is there are new standards for advertising and for podcast specifications that have changed up things. So if we make the app compliant, other things have to change in this and that. Bear with us. We're doing the best we can. We're not one of these companies that are funded to the tune of $2 million or $3 million or really nobody funds us. I mean, everybody is a customer. We do not have big-time investors or anything like that because I let Michael run the IPO offering and it didn't work out. And so here we are. JointheMajorityReport.com. As always, if you want the fun half but don't have the financial resources to swing it, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will hook you up. We don't want to lock anybody out for financial reasons. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And Michael's not here, but he will be here tomorrow night for TMBS. Matt, do you have any idea what's going to go on there? Just a bunch of attitude, I bet.
Yeah, mainly attitude. I don't even know who the guests are, so I can't really plug it. So
it's going to be...
Just watch. I mean, check it out, though.
A lot of attitude. Free Lula. And...
Yeah, there'll probably be a Lula segment.
I mean, things are heating up with that right now in mm-hmm. a big way. That the story, The Intercept broke. Mm-hmm. Big deal.
Michael's been doing a Michael Tracy like victory lap.
Oh yeah, going around
developments.
I saw him go and taunt Jimmy Dore, insisting that he apologized to his audience for. That's not true. Jamie, what's happening with the Antifada?
This week on the Antifada, we have on Ben Burgess, author of "Give Them an Argument: Logic for the Left." We spoke with him about, oh no, it's loading. I was reading it off Patreon. I guess I'll just have to remember what we talked about. How Marx could be the messiest bitch of the 19th century and still remain logically sound. Ben Shapiro, Stephen Molyneux, my run-in with an Elon Musk fanboy. So that is in the main episode and the bonus as well. We continue our conversation. And that all came out last week and it's out now. Also this past weekend, we recorded an episode with Sophie Wiener, who's been on the show once before. She's in studio for the first time ever. She's visiting from Australia. And we talked about her new technozine called Pluralitariat, which is a socialist technozine, and how we can use this kind of the kind of spaces opened up by party culture to try to radicalize both the culture and the world at large. We also, later in the week, have a bonus coming featuring Sophie Wiener as well. It is a Real Crime Think Hours, where we talk about an infamous Crime Think article about how the necessity of washing yourself and smelling good is just a capitalist conspiracy. So,
oh yeah, I knew that.
Check it out.
Matt.
Yeah, check out Literary Hangover. The most recent episode for patrons is the Such Were the Joys essay by George Orwell on his time at prep school. On Thursday, I'm recording it's going to be a really long episode. The first part is going to be sort of a sketch of the utopian socialist movements that made it to America, specifically the one of Charles Fourier, who is this French guy who thought we needed to make communities of exactly 1,620 people. That would be ideal. And they need to be like sort of giant Versailles type phalanxes, they'd call them. And also human activity is going to warm up the atmosphere.
I've read about this dude.
An interesting guy. And a lot of the things, he talked a lot about sex, so that kind of scandalized a lot of people. But he also predicted that the environment would heat up because of human activity. Mm. Which is an interesting prediction. He went a little bit farther.
It's all the sex.
And then he said the melt of the ice caps would make the oceans taste like lemonade. And that's something that everybody who likes to discredit him likes to bring up. No credit has ever not mentioned that part. But it would be cool if it... And maybe he's right. Who knows?
Well, they may taste more lemonade-y.
Yeah.
Not necessarily like lemonade.
Well, no. He said it tastes like lemonade.
Well, lemonade may have tasted differently than back then, too. So you never know. They were very salty with their lemonade.
They said expect a delicious treat. So
it took a while to get the formula right.
Yeah. And he also thought we would be able to ride like these sort of robot tigers or something around. But anyway, he inspired Americans. They set up one called Brook Farm that Nathaniel Hawthorne went to. And he thought it was kind of BS. So he left after about a few months. But then he wrote a satire about it.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.